News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake. There's
nothing. Welcome back. Today is Friday, November 4th. I'm Anya Zolojowski.
And I'm Francesca Bianco. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia, to our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's 5 o'clock. And time for a full half hour of independent campus, local, and international news.
To start the show, News 101 reporter Anya Christina discusses the role of the media in framing the narrative surrounding Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton in the U.S. presidential elections. Anya spoke with James Hammond, a UBC Master of Political Science student, about the news coverage on both candidates and whether it has operated under the assumption of false equivalency.
Following that, we have News 101 reporter Yusheng Kai exploring the role of super PACs in the U.S. presidential elections. Yusheng interviewed PhD candidate Eric Merkley from UBC's Political Science Department to find out more about super PACs and whether they have the capacity to influence public opinion.
To finish off our show, we have a weekly roundup of the top financial stories by News 101's financial news reporter Alex Norman.
But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, a round of consultations on UBC's new sexual assault policy came to an end on Monday. These information sessions were designed to invite students and faculty to offer feedback on how to prevent and improve response to sexual assaults on campus. UBC unveiled a new sexual assault policy in June of this year, but critics said that the policy lacked clarity and failed to include a new process for reporting and investigating assaults. The university began drafting a new policy after UBC student Glynis Kirchmeyer and other women alleged in November that the school had postponed acting on a number of complaints against a male PhD candidate. Earlier this year, Kirchmeyer filed a human rights complaint with the BC Human Rights Tribunal against the university for its handling of sexual assault reports. The case remains unresolved. In April, BC introduced legislation demanding universities to have sexual misconduct policies amidst allegations that schools are failing survivors of campus violence. In the meantime, more consultations are set to take place next year with redrafted versions. A final version will be approved by May to meet the legislative deadline. A Facebook page dedicated to bringing awareness to mental health issues has gained over 1,000 likes in less than a week. UBC student Ji-Yoon Kim kickstarted the page entitled The Tipping Point in April this year after experiencing her own struggles with mental health. Over 30 students have personally reached out to Kim through her page for support. Kim eventually dropped out of UBC in April after realizing that she was suffering from academic-related anxiety. Her goal is to push post-secondary institutions to actively address the issue of mental health by ensuring that students have access to adequate resources and support. She is also aiming to encourage UBC to implement a system that allows for more academic flexibility. Earlier this month, UBC President Santa Jayono highlighted the need for more rigorous research on mental health.
In local news, one person has been charged with second-degree murder and aggravated assault in connection with the fatal stabbing of 13-year-old Letitia Reimer. The incident occurred in an Abbotsford high school on Tuesday. The man arrested is 21-year-old Gabriel Brandon Klein and is believed to have no connection to the student and reportedly no criminal records prior to the incident. Abbotsford police have noted that there is little information available on the man. Abbotsford police have also stated that Klein was responsible for attacking a 14-year-old girl in the school who is currently recovering in hospital. She is said to be in stable condition. Police said on Wednesday that Klein was of no fixed address and had been seen in different areas in the Lower Mainland since February or March and was last seen in Vancouver. The incident was captured on video by one student. CBC has reported that Chief Bob Rich of the Abbotsford Police Department has asked that the video not be shared or broadcast out of respect for students' families. The incident has prompted school districts in Abbotsford and Vancouver to review their security protocols following Tuesday's attacks. Housing prices in Vancouver have dropped noticeably in the first time in 4 years. According to the Real Estate Board of Greater Vancouver, the standard home is down to $919,300 a year. This is a decrease of about 0.8% from September. The REBGV previously reported that the standard price as $900,031. It was later revised to $926,600, a figure down by 0.7% from August. The board also said that sales and listings in the Greater Vancouver area have dropped below historical averages for the month of October. Residential property sales totaled 2,233 last month, a 0.9% decrease from the previous month, and a 38.8% decline from last year. In August, the BC government implemented a 15% tax for foreign nationals buying residential property in Metro Vancouver in an effort to stabilize the area's housing prices, which have been among the highest in North America.
In national news, police surveillance of reporters becomes a raging issue denied by Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. The Prime Minister said he immediately engaged with the heads of the National Police Force and spy agency after troubling reports of surveillance on reporters in Quebec, and said both confirmed no similar tracking was taking place at the federal level. He states, "We have strong safeguards and protections to protect freedom of the press conducted by CSIS and RCMP at the federal level." Trudeau's remarks came as the Quebec government called an inquiry into a growing scandal over police spying on journalists. Two police forces in the provinces have admitted to telephone surveillance of reporters. A news conference in Ottawa was held yesterday in response to a federal court ruling on the agency's handling of metadata collected under warrant. CSIS Director Michel Coulombe offered assurances that his agency was not conducting surveillance on reporters. He said, "I completely agree with the PM on this issue, and such a situation is not happening at the federal level." However, when asked by reporters whether his agency has ever performed surveillance on reporters, Coulombe said he could not comment on operational details. NDP leader Tom Mulcair recalls reports of RCMP officers tailing two Ottawa-based reporters, calling for a federal inquiry during yesterday's question period.
In international news, New York Elementary School cancels mock presidential election after kids spew negative rhetoric about minorities. Further concern for the influence of American presidential election has on America's youth is spurring. Glenn Rogers, principal of Jericho Elementary School in Center Reach, New York, spoke with ABC News today, saying teachers and staff members raised concerns about what students were repeating from presidential candidates Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump. These New York students were discouraged to proceed with their mock election once teachers had noticed the divide between Clinton and Trump supporters within the grade 5 classroom, turned to aggressive argument of which candidate is worse. The school principal told ABC News that not wanting minority students to feel uncomfortable, the school decided to tweak the mock election from voting for presidents to voting for favorite school lunch. "We question, can this shift effectively educate students on the parliamentary system without dealing with the issue directly?" Rogers said, "We still thought it was important to do something with voting and showing democracy in action." He also said, "We still want them to get excited about Election Day." Thus, the question remains, is it truly possible to separate extremist political views and campaigns from younger generations? Or should schools, rather than conceal the controversy of the Trump campaign, explore its flaws in an educational setting? Mediterranean Sea to have its deadliest year ever. Migration officials said that more than 200 migrants fleeing to Europe are believed to have drowned in two shipwrecks off of the coast of Libya. Many of those killed in the latest two incidents are believed to be migrants from West Africa. According to International Organization of Migration spokesman Leonard Doyle, more than 4,200 migrants have died making the dangerous journey across the Mediterranean Sea this year. The United Nations has warned 2016 could be the deadliest year for migrants making this journey. Nearly 330,000 migrants have crossed the sea so far this year, compared with more than 1 million in 2015. Italy has seen an increase in the trafficking of migrants from Libya ever since an agreement between the European Union and Turkey agreement was made this March to halt migrants traveling to the Greek islands. This agreement has drastically reduced the number of boat arrivals there. There is now an increase in traffic in the journey between North Africa and Italy. On Monday, the Italian Coast Guard said it recovered the bodies of 16 people during 21 rescue missions. 2,200 migrants were saved from only 18 rubber boats. The desperate rubber boats and exceeding capacity of people in combination with dangerous weather conditions are causing most journeys to end in high death rates and making it difficult for missionaries to save everyone.
Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
Do you have no direction?
Are you trying to make sense of this absurd existence that we experience on a daily basis?
Do you wish to find meaning in this existential quagmire that is the daily grind?
Well, come on down to CITR for Volunteer Wednesdays from 11 to 1 p.m. every week and find your meaning in life. No experience is necessary, so what are you waiting for, Sisyphus? Life is knocking.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at CITR.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Right now, News 101 reporter Anya Christina discusses the role of the media in framing the narrative surrounding Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton in the U.S. presidential elections. Anya spoke with James Hammond, a UBC Master of Political Science student, on whether news coverage on both candidates has operated under the assumption of false equivalency.
I've been paying a lot of attention to the media coverage surrounding the American election lately. One of the biggest debates stems from the idea of false equivalency. For those of you who don't know, false equivalency implies that two otherwise unequal entities are presented and compared as if they are in fact equal. So in the current context, because Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are both running for the presidency, and journalists have to, in theory, cover the elections fairly and without bias, two candidates with unequal credentials and qualifications are being presented as equals. Journalists have clearly had to make tough calls when covering the two presidential candidates. But what is the right approach? Should journalists frame Clinton favorably and place emphasis on the fact that she has more experience and is more qualified than Trump? Or should they highlight the less favorable qualities and scandals of both candidates equally? I decided to chat with James Hammond, a UBC master's student in political science, to get his take. Hey James, how's it going?
Hi there.
So, first question. Do you think that false equivalency between the two candidates exists and that Clinton should be framed as the superior candidate? Or do you believe that both candidates need to be measured by the same stick for the duration of this election?
I think that's perhaps how the coverage of the election started, certainly back in the days of the primary. There was clearly an effort, I think, from the media to try and be impartial in their judgings of the candidates. But I think people are beginning to kind of wake up to the idea that perhaps journalism has greater responsibility than just seeming to appear impartial. I think we have to really be aware that Trump is an exceptional candidate. And certainly in, you know, academic circles, this is the same sort of issue that we are constantly addressed with, is how do we go about talking about Trump without kind of sort of descending into, you know, cliches and quickly, you know, not getting anywhere in terms of productive. And now journalists are striving to, you know, try and present these two candidates as both being on a level playing field, both trying to talk about both candidates in the same voice, when really I do not think it's possible to do so. So what I think the media should be doing is not focusing on scandal, not focusing on experience even, but this false dichotomy needs to be overcome, because there is one huge dichotomy, but that's on their ideology. That's on what they believe should be the policy solutions for America going into the 21st century. And, you know, there is clearly a difference. One guy wants to build a wall, the other wants, you know, a path to citizenship for illegal immigrants.
Question, to kind of go into that deeper as well, because you touched on how you would think that you should be focusing on the policies and the ideologies of the candidates more so than the scandals. But is it possible that the false equivalency prevents journalists from digging deeper into the complex political agendas of both candidates? Because, for example, maybe if more criticism of Clinton was deemed okay, then journalists could investigate her alleged complacency towards the Israeli occupation of the West Bank.
The collective failing of journalism to really not address policies. I mean, right. Even now, as we begin to sense that, you know, the media's waking up and the media's starting to really kind of dig into Trump and really presenting Trump not as a, you know, normal candidate, but as, you know, it's quite an exception and as quite an exceptional election season. But still, you know, policies don't sell. You know, politicians themselves struggle to get across policy information, and this is, you know, in political science, this is a constant issue we're faced with, is how can we get people actually better involved in the policy-making process? Ideas of very, very complex issues. I've never been more disappointed in a presidential debate than I was in the three that we've had this year. Yeah. They were the most exciting and the most scandalous and the most sexy, you know. Trump's dragging out accusers of Clinton, and, you know, Clinton's bashing him and throwing names about what he said about women and this Miss Universe, and it's all sensationalized and it's all fantastic. But we never actually even got to talk about a lot of policies beyond cliches and simple fixes. And, you know, that, I think, is the saddest part of this election, that we never, ever got to discuss those issues. And actually, interestingly,
Sorry to cut you off. So are you saying that it's not so much the fault of false equivalency that we haven't managed to get deeper into certain policy measures or the political agendas of the candidates, but it is the sexy celebrity and kind of affinity for scandal that voters themselves and the media promotes that has led to that surface level understanding?
I certainly do think so.
If I can summarize a little bit, the false equivalency here isn't actually a problem, and in fact, given Trump's exceptional rhetoric, it's a legitimate thing, and you believe that journalists, in a sense, have to question their responsibility when they are presenting a particular position to or story to their audience, and part of that means highlighting Donald Trump's inflammatory
rhetoric. The media is fundamental to the functioning of a democracy, and fundamental to the functioning of a democracy is ensuring that certain norms continue, you know, on. And if a candidate is fundamentally challenging the norms that govern how democracy works in America, that's kind of a big deal. You know, that's not, are you Democrat or Republican? That's, are you Democratic? And, you know, the media, more than any other institution involved in an election process, has the responsibility to make sure that certain norms, certain rules are adhered to.
James made a number of interesting points. Although there's a widely held belief that journalists should remain unbiased, in the case of this exceptional election, it is difficult to ignore the reality that Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump are not equals. James may be right. Influential voices need to stand up for what is democratic. Otherwise, we may see an era of American politics ripe with prejudice.
Thanks, Enya. Now, News 101 reporter Yusheng Tsai explores the role of super PACs in the U.S. presidential elections. Yusheng interviewed PhD candidate Eric Merkley from UBC's Political Science Department to find out more about super PACs and their capacity to influence public opinion.
Both pro-Clinton and anti-Clinton super PACs are acting in the wake of Mrs. Clinton's renewed email scandal. Priorities USA Action, Mrs. Clinton's top dollar super PAC, in an attempt to boost turnout among women, is now spreading $6 million across 9 television markets in 3 states. Wisconsin, Florida, and Pennsylvania. Meanwhile, on top of the reopened probe by FBI into Mrs. Clinton's email server, Sheldon Adelson, a casino mogul who had been skimping on Trump's campaign, has recently gave $25 million to an anti-Clinton super PAC. The large amount of money for both sides called public attention to the issue of super PAC. How is super PAC going, and what the role does it play in both public opinion and this year's presidential election? I spoke to Professor Eric Merkley on Wednesday, a PhD candidate in political science at University of British Columbia, whose researching areas are U.S. elections, campaign strategy and tactics, election polling, role of the media, voter behavior and psychology, internal party politics. Here's what he thinks about Super PAC.
It's a mechanism for parties to raise money, not parties specifically, but candidates to do so, independent of the organizations of the political parties. So they play a role in both primaries and general elections, because again, it is this mechanism to raise vast sums of money. Elections in the United States are getting more expensive every cycle, and it's a way for parties to overcome that. It plays similar roles, though. If you're able to get a lot of super PAC donations, your side, though not your campaign specifically, because you're not allowed to be associated with them, is able to fund TV advertisements. That's the big dollar costs in primaries and general elections. So they play a similar role in that regard. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump have been relatively even in the amount of donations that they've raised from super PACs. Where the big difference is in both the candidates' individual fundraising. So Hillary Clinton is able to outspend Donald Trump on television advertisements because he's able to raise a lot more money. But that fundraising gap isn't because of the difference in super PAC donations. So they both are relatively even on super PACs. Now, this is different from 2012. In 2012, Republicans were able to outraise Democrats in terms of super PACs, but this year it's a bit more even. So both Trump's campaign and Hillary Clinton's campaign benefit from super PACs relatively evenly. Hillary Clinton is able to get a lot more money from other sources, and that is giving her fundraising edge. Now, this fundraising edge hasn't really amounted to much in terms of influencing public opinion. She's outspent Donald Trump consistently over the course of the election campaign, and it hasn't really fundamentally altered the race, it seems. So a lot of this money, it seems to be for naught.
Super PACs came into existence in July 2010, following two key federal court decisions that found limitations on both corporate and individual contributions to be unconstitutional violations of the First Amendment right to free speech. However, super PACs appear to have failed in this year's presidential election. According to the Center for Responsive Politics, total super PAC contributions from donors giving $500,000 or more now top $1 billion. That's over twice the amount of money from super PAC's donors at this point in the 2012 campaign, and even exceeds the combined amount of soft money donations from 1999 until they were banned in 2002. Because of that, some critics think super PACs open up the floodgate for corruption.
We don't have enough data, really, to say what the influence of super PACs has been on the policy process or anything along those lines. I'm not one to tend to exaggerate the role of money in politics. I think there's a lot of research that has shown some pretty kind of nuanced conclusions about how donations affect policy outcomes. It's not really clear from that literature that there is that kind of a corrosive process that results from money entering politics. That being said, we need to do more research and find out what exactly that effect is, but we don't really know enough at the time now about how much it matters. I will note that people tend to exaggerate how effective money can be in American politics, but you can look at Jeb Bush, who was able to raise tremendous amounts of money, and he got absolutely nowhere in the Republican primaries, despite waves and waves of advertising funded by big donors. Donald Trump was able to prevail. Similarly, Hillary Clinton is outspending Donald Trump, and this is a close race when it shouldn't be. So we can't exaggerate the effect of donations on election outcomes. Other things like partisanship and race matter way more in terms of determining how Americans are going to vote and the state of the economy and factors like that than how much money a candidate's able to spend. So I can't really draw a pretty strong conclusion either way, but I would be skeptical of claims that there is such a massive corrosive effect, and I would definitely reject that super PACs are somehow able to buy elections. That's just not how it works in the U.S.
Thank you, Yusheng. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned for more contributor segments.
Discorder,
a magazine from CITR 101.9 FM,
presents a showcase of emerging Vancouver-based hip-hop artists Friday, November 18th at the Media Club.
The lineup is comprised of some of the most talked about and should be talked about hip-hop artists in Vancouver,
including So Loki, Missy D, Romy, Something August, Spotty Joseph, and Freeman Young, with CITR's Crimes and Treasons DJing and emceeing this 19-plus event.
We them boys! Be sure to come check us out. We're Crimes and Treasons Radio. We're going to be hosting and DJing at the Media Club. Be sure to come check us out.
Crimes and Treasons.
For more information and tickets, visit discorder.ca.
Welcome back to News 101. You are listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at CITR.ca, broadcasting live from unceded Musqueam territory here at the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Now we have a weekly roundup by News 101's financial news reporter Alex Norman on the top financial stories this week.
This is the weekly financial update report with Alex Norman, keeping you updated with what's going on in the markets. These are this week's top stories for Thursday, October 27th to Thursday, November 3rd, 2006. The British Parliament votes against Brexit. Bauer's parent company files for bankruptcy. A dispute between Visa and Walmart continues to heat up in Canada. And Elon Musk reveals SolarCity's new big project. We begin today's news with England's High Court ruling on Thursday that the British government will require parliamentary approval to trigger the process of exiting the European Union. This complicates Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit plans. The government said it would appeal the process and that the British Supreme Court has set aside December 5th to 8th to deal with the matter. The sterling rose on the news, with many investors taking the view that lawmakers could make a possibility of a hard Brexit less likely. Quote, this is a fundamental ruling of the UK's constitution, that the parliament is sovereign and can make and unmake any law that it chooses, said Lord Chief Justice John Thomas. May's government said in a statement that it was disappointed with the court's decision. Got a pair of Bauer hockey skates? Well, Austin Matthews of the Toronto Maple Leafs may have to ditch his. Alexander Ovechkin, Jonathan Toews, Patrick Kane, and other high-profile NHL players may find their endorsement contracts with Bauer Hockey canceled as early as Monday. Performance Sports Ltd., the maker of Bauer hockey gear, said on Monday that it has filed for bankruptcy protection in the United States and Canada to facilitate a restructuring and the sale of most of its assets. The company, which also makes baseball bats and other sporting equipment, said that it has put up its assets for auction, but it already has a deal to sell nearly all of it for $775 million U.S. to investor groups led by Sengard Capital, its biggest shareholder, and Fairfax Financial Group Ltd. Shares in Performance Sports Group Ltd. were down for the week, closing on Thursday at $5.02 for a 6.57% loss. And round two begins in the Canadian battle between Visa and Walmart. Visa Canada is offering its Manitoba cardholders a reward if they buy their groceries somewhere else other than Walmart. The credit card giant has launched an advertising campaign in which it's offering a $10 credit to Manitoba cardholders who spend $50 or more on groceries in other stores other than Walmart in the province. Visa is in the midst of a fee dispute with Walmart, which has stopped accepting cards at 16 of its Manitoba locations. The retail giant vowed in June that it would stop accepting Visa at all of its 400 Canadian outlets if Visa doesn't lower its fees, which it charges to Walmart. A Canadian food industry analyst at Dalhousie University in Nova Scotia describes the latest move by Visa as interesting and unusual. Quote, the main reason why Visa is refusing to cave to Walmart's demands is that if it does, other retailers will demand a reduction in their fees as well. Walmart says that it pays more than $100 million in fees annually for its customers to be able to use the cards, and that Visa's fees are too high. Visa, Canada's largest credit card company, responded by saying that it offers Walmart one of its lowest rates to any merchants in the country, but the retailer just wants more. Shares in Visa were down for the week, closing on Thursday at $80.65 for a 1.55 loss. Elon Musk of Tesla unveils his secret plan this weekend, and he wants to make solar panels sexy as his electric cars. This past Friday, Elon Musk captured public attention when he announced SolarCity's latest upcoming project, Solar Roofs. Unlike conventional solar panels, Tesla and SolarCity have developed glass roof tiles that are embedded with devices that convert sunlight into electricity. Quote, the goal is to make solar roofs that look better than normal roofs, generate electricity, last longer, have better insulation, and cost less than a normal roof plus the cost of electricity, said Musk. The new product comes as Elon Musk tries to persuade its shareholders to approve Tesla's proposed $2.2 billion acquisition of SolarCity, the United States' largest home solar panel installer. Shareholders on both sides of the transaction are scheduled to vote on the merger on November 17th. Shares in SolarCity were down this week, closing on Thursday at $18.55 for a 10.13% loss. In other market news, these are this week's numbers. Toronto's S&P TSX Composite Index was down 1.72% to close at 14,583 points on Thursday. The broader S&P 500 index was also down this week, posting a loss of 2.8% to close at 2,088 points on Thursday. The Nasdaq also closed this week with a loss of 3.02%. In the European markets, the German DAX closed down this week 3.65%. In the Asian indices, the Japanese Nikkei posted a loss of 2.92% and the Shanghai Composite Index was up 0.56%. In the commodities market, December gold futures closed up this week to close at $1,303 an ounce, while the December crude futures were down this week 7.44% to close at $44.75 a barrel. In natural gas, December future contracts were down 9.52% to close at $2.08 a unit. In the bond market, yields for 10-year Canadian bonds are currently at 1.2%. U.S. 10-year Treasury yields closed lower this week at a rate of 1.8026%. This has been the weekly financial update report with Alex Norman, keeping you updated with what's going on in the markets.
Thank you, Alex. That's our program for today, November 4th. Today's newscast was brought to you by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our Facebook, Twitter, or even email us at news@citr.ca.
You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/radio/news-101. You can also find great content on our SoundCloud and Mixcloud pages. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Francesca.
And I'm Anya. Today's broadcast was produced by Sahara Saf and Nicole Stevens. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening.
Stay tuned for Sean Harbottle's Hippity Hoppity Brigade show at 6 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM.
Is my shimmering life prize. All I must do is create a diversion. What could distract people who love sports? Sports. Sports.
Sports.
Sports.
Sports.
Sports. Sports.
Do you find sports distracting? Feel the need to chant sports for hours on end? Then come on by the CITR station at the new sub to get involved. We do play-by-play, color commentary, audio production, interviews, and so much more. Only on CITR 101.9 FM.
Discorder, that free magazine from CITR, has been documenting the best in music, arts, and culture since 1983.